Why class actions should be changing your advertising program.
In this podcast, we discuss the following: recent updates from the courts in class action lawsuits, a difference between equity and law, demerging or diverging equity and law, dictionaries used by courts to interpret contracts, an update on the Johnson & Johnson baby powder case, what experts need to be cautious of to avoid false advertising allegations against them, and finally, an update on the Maybelline 24-hour makeup case. Rebecca Tushnet is our guest. She's a Harvard Law School professor specializing in copyright, trademark, and advertising law. Let's get into it. Is a perennial favorite, and I'm really happy to have her on. Before we get started, Rebecca, tell us more about yourself.
So I'm a professor at Harvard Law School. I teach copyright, trademark, and advertising law, and I love to talk about them.
And you have a blog that I follow very, very closely, so you should follow that as well. Try to put that in the show notes. But Rebecca, today we're going to talk in the context of advertising law about the changes in class action lawsuits. And you told me that there have been some updates recently from the courts. So tell me more.
Federal courts in particular long sort of despised class actions. And so there's always an interest in sort of developing new ways to get rid of them. And in combination with the Supreme Court's fairly aggressive turn to invalidating various things on constitutional grounds. New tactics are developing. So we start with the idea of standing, which is you need to have some sort of injury that is redressable in order for a federal court to hear your claim. And the way that courts have been treating this, they say, like, if you have standing for damages, you might not have standing for injunctive relief, because just because you've been harmed in the past doesn't mean you'll be harmed again in the future. And that's pretty important to a lot of consumer protection cases, because in many cases, one of the most important forms of relief is actually getting them to stop whatever they're doing, because the individual, you know, monetary damage is likely to be very small. So courts are increasingly saying, nope, maybe you can get damages for the false advertising in the past, but you know the truth now, so you can't be deceived in the future. Or it's not likely that you'll be deceived in the future. And so, you know, we'll kick out cases on that ground. Also, courts have been saying, well, it doesn't matter if the state law provides you with a so-called equitable remedy, like disgorgement of the profits. The federal rule is, if you can get damages, then you have to only get damages, and we have to kick out all the so-called equitable claims. And this goes back to basically the medieval English distinction between law and equity, which, you know, 100 years or so didn't really have any purchase in modern law, but it's being revived. The founders thought that there was a difference between law and equity, and so we have to continue to implement it, even though we don't actually have law courts and equity courts anymore the way that they did in merry old England. And then more aggressively, I was really interested in a recent case, Shelby Racing Car. So GM advertised these cars as track ready, but in fact, sold a whole bunch of them with engines that would basically crap out if you drove them at track speeds. There was obviously a big lawsuit, and the Court of Appeals only partially allowed a class action, and they're over a dissent that wouldn't have allowed any class action at all, basically on the grounds that mechanism itself was sort of incompatible with due process under the circumstances, that basically it was too big. You couldn't be sure why everyone in the class had bought their Shelby, even though, you know, there's a difference between the two models. Like, you paid more and you got an actual track ready car, and you paid less and you didn't, despite their advertising. It was really a sign to me of the fact that many lower court judges are feeling sort of newly empowered. You know, just because we've been doing something this way for 80 years doesn't mean we're going to keep doing it this way. And, you know, obviously there are kind of really popular really noticeable things like affirmative action and abortion. But it's important to know that's happening sort of across the board, even with sort of non, you know, newspaper story worthy doctrines.
Can we start from the beginning, which is you start with the original concept of the courts taking the position that do you have standing? And the basis of that was, well, you know the truth now, so I don't have to actually have an injunctive relief at this point. I don't have to stop you. My question, though, is doesn't that mean that the damage for other people will keep going. Like, so what is the thought process there for the court?
For assistance with your advertising compliance needs, feel free to contact us at darshan@kulkarnilawfirm.com.
The claim is that even if you're a class representative, right, so you're standing in for a bunch of unnamed class members, the courts have decided that if you, the named class representative, don't have standing to seek injunctive relief, the fact that the unnamed class members still don't know, they're still ignorant, isn't enough to justify granting injunctive relief. This has actually been the rule for a fairly long time, but courts are applying it more aggressively in consumer protection cases than they did historically. This actually got its start in a police brutality case called Los Angeles versus Lyons, where this guy had been choked by the LA police and he sued them. And he said, you know, what I really want is for you to stop training your officers to choke people. And the Supreme Court said, he can get damages for himself being unlawfully choked, but there's just, you know, it's not super likely he'll be choked again. And so he can't have standing. And of course, if you're unnamed, you don't know you're in the class and you can't show up and say, but I'm likely to be choked, or, you know, but I don't know the truth. By the very fact of your showing up as named, you know the truth. So it's a particular issue in false advertising cases.
So the next thing you raised was this idea of law versus equity. Now, for those people who went to law school, we heard a lot about it, but the honest truth is, 20 years out of law school, I don't even remember what the difference is. I remember equity being this concept of fair play almost, while law being, well, it's codified almost. But talk to me a little bit about what the actual difference is.
Well, so part of the problem is, right, the U.S. system unified law and equity, you know, a very long time ago. But the Supreme Court has recently shown interest in holding that anything that was traditionally equitable stays equitable. So all the rules for it stay the same. Including that equity isn't available unless there's no legal remedy. The definition is quite fuzzy. So we have, you know, damages are considered legal, but restitution is considered equitable. But especially in a false advertising case, like, what is the difference between getting damages and restitution? They're often pretty much the same. But injunctive relief is also considered equitable. So that turns out to be another reason, you know, you can't get an injunction to fix stuff. But it doesn't make a lot of sense to, you know, investigate this because the concepts themselves are pretty archaic and have very little to do with, you know, what we today think law ought to be doing.
So that's fascinating, but very complicated because at a practical level, I'm thinking about the next contract I have to write. And I want to include in there that a standard clause, as you know, is that you will have the right for injunctive relief if necessary and all that kind of good stuff. Does this change what that clause says now?
That's a really interesting question. So first of all, in state court, none of this has to apply. So, you know, if you're thinking about state level remedies, it's just not gonna work the same way. But even in federal court, so far, courts generally think that either the legislature or private parties can decide for themselves, right? So the real effect of this is on tort claims. Where, you know, it's not a voluntary transaction. You know, if you're in a voluntary transaction, you can probably, then it depends on the judge and whether the judge believes that you've actually identified, you know, irreparable harm just by breach of the agreement.
What I hear you saying is, yeah, you might be able to draft it into the contract and you might be able to address this in the contract. The problem is no one knows what to put in there because no one knows specifically what equity means because, as you pointed out, the U.S. merged the concept of equity and law a while ago. But now we're coming back at this new phase where we may be demerging it or diverging it or whatever the word would be. So assume the worst and assume that there might be a divergence. What is the impact now?
For assistance with your advertising compliance needs, call me at 302-252-6959.
Honestly, in terms of sort of private agreements, what it seems to me is the biggest thing is contract interpretation. Courts are increasingly being encouraged to just look at the dictionary So in interpreting things. And so I would sort of worry about that more generally, just because there's a, course of dealing between the parties. Maybe that'll matter. But, you know, there are a lot of classic law school cases like, does chicken mean young, eating chicken or old, washed up chicken? And what happens if you don't specify in the contract, which kind of chickens can you expect to get? So that kind of thing. With the overall trend of courts to look more at dictionaries, I think making sure that you define anything that you care about is going to be increasingly important. And, obviously that was always important, but knowing that the court is going to look at a dictionary kind of as first might be useful in thinking about that.
So that's really interesting. So now what becomes important or critical is which dictionary. When you advise, and I recognize you come from an academic side, but I'm sure you get asked these questions all the time, are we now all thinking Black's Law Dictionary, or do you go, the average person isn't looking at Blacks?
Yeah, you go to like Webster's.
Now, I can get a difference between Webster's versus Oxford, and I'll choose the one that I like. There is no, here's where to go. This is, what is a reasonable person going to assume? Is that the standard?
It's actually not that, because that's not necessarily what's in the dictionary, right? So it's more like the Supreme Court is sort of setting the tone. There's an objective truth for everything, and the objective truth is guided by pretty much what the standard dictionary definition says. So, of course, there's a huge amount of discretion in that. And I think one of the problems that we're facing sort of in general is that there's a lot of interpretive overconfidence and sort of not, it turns out there are things that are ambiguous. And if you don't acknowledge that, then you end up sort of claiming a unitary nature of meaning that leaves other people, I think, feeling quite alienated because they didn't share that understanding. And so, when it comes to drafting contracts, you actually have more control over that than almost anything else, because you get to say what you mean. So, in fact, if you're in contract land, you're actually better off than relatively. Mark Lemley has this paper called Chief Justice Webster, which is about the use of the dictionary to kind of override everything else.
What you're talking about is the emergence of the dictionary as you put it, Chief Justice, which reminds me, the dictionary is still a private institution, which means that you are going to see companies sue the dictionary eventually for their interpretation. And an example of that is the J&J case you actually talked about, where they went after expert witnesses. Could you talk a little bit about that case?
So J&J made Johnson & Johnson's baby powder, which was accused of being related to cases of mesothelioma. And J&J has been trying a bunch of things to deal with these cases, including basically separated a subsidiary called LTL. And then that subsidiary went into bankruptcy. And basically all it has is some money from J&J and all the liabilities. And there's ongoing litigation about whether it's okay to use bankruptcy that way. Seems pretty hinky to me, but I'm not a bankruptcy expert. So anyway, another thing it's doing is it's suing the plaintiff's witnesses for basically defamation and false advertising about the link between the baby powder and mesothelioma. And it's saying, you made false claims and you caused us a bunch of economic harm. And it's really quite shockingly aggressive because, of course, lots of people in tort cases dispute the facts by the other side's experts, but accusing them of false advertising and defamation is really something. And ordinarily we have a bunch of doctrines that are supposed to protect witnesses in trials, but J&J or LTL is trying to get around that by saying, yeah, but you also made these claims outside the trials, like in your published research, and then you used your research to basically advertise for clients. And so we can sue you for false advertising for that.
I see that as a possibly aggressive take, but what is stopping let's say a disgruntled employee who does want to generate business. Talk to me a little bit about why that is not a reasonable position to take. I agree it's an aggressive position. Talk me through why it's not reasonable.
For assistance with your advertising compliance needs, feel free to contact us at Darshan at KulkarniLawFirm.com.
So for one thing, already by changing it to an employee, you're starting to get closer to kind of what I would say are legitimate business interests, where, you know, an insider saying things is actually different than somebody who has sort of scientific or medical expertise, right? So, ordinarily we'd say resolve these differences in the court dispute, and maybe the expert is wrong, maybe the expert is right, but the ordinary mechanisms of the trial are where that comes out. And you know, if J&J or LTL can prove that the expert's wrong, the expert will definitely pay a professional consequence, you know, reputational consequence, and that matters. The threat of, you know, losing your house because you disagreed with a company on the science seems quite troubling to me.
The next question then becomes, what is the appropriate remedy for this? Is this going to be like a motion to dismiss and go, this is unreasonable and this should be thrown out for failure to state a claim? Or are courts willing to entertain these?
So courts have historically been pretty hesitant about these kinds of claims. But in recent years, I've seen a couple where, you know, the court allows false advertising claims against an expert to continue. I think we talked about it one of these last time where somebody was on the panel that sort of approved a nutrition claim. And then, you know, also worked as a consultant for the company, and the competitor sued for false advertising, and the court said, yeah, you know, maybe this guy had enough of a role that we can hold him liable, even though his main role was like participating in the panel. And then, you know, he got paid, you know, by the firm. So I'm not saying he wasn't financially interested, but it's sort of notable. You know, and part of it perhaps is that we no longer have any confidence that reputational sanctions matter. Basically, and we're also sort of in a crisis of expertise more generally. You know, if there are no standards, or if there are no agreement on standards, then how do we discipline claims, even scientific claims?
Right. So let me ask you a different question from the perspective of the expert. What do I need to do to make these claims go away so that I'm not risking my house every single time I go on there as an expert?
Yeah, that is a great question. And so one answer, I think, is we need a federal anti-SLAPP law. So SLAPPs are strategic lawsuits against public participation, right? So, you know, suing your critics is a time-honored way of getting them to shut up. And so a number of states have these anti-SLAPP laws where if there is something that relates to an issue of public interest, if your claim is based on speech related to an issue of public interest, you can basically get an expedited hearing where the plaintiff has to very quickly kind of put up or shut up. And if they lose the anti-SLAPP hearing, they have to pay your fees. And so that's actually useful, right? It helps. So it's not cost free. And also it's potentially quite costly to bring an unjustified suit against speech. So I would say a federal anti-SLAPP law would be a great idea for these. Until then, it's a motion to dismiss.
Which takes us to the last situation we want to talk a little bit about. And you talked about the 24-hour makeup case before we jumped on. Now, I have a little bit of bone to pick here, and I'll tell you why. I used to work at a pharmacy, and the pharmacy used to advertise one-hour photo. That was their thing. And someone came in and said, how long is this going to be? And we were like, 2 hours. Well, it says one-hour photo right there. And what you're telling me is, that is the exact same situation, 24-hour makeup, but it doesn't last for 24 hours. So what is the similarity? What's the update? Tell me
one of the things about makeup, of course, is makeup is a series of promises. And so there's often disputes about, like, well, I assume, could a reasonable person believe that, you know, if you use CoverGirl mascara, you'll look like Taylor Swift? Well, no. You won't, right? On the other hand, when Taylor Swift is in the ad, you know, do you believe they put CoverGirl mascara on her? So this happens with like digitally altering retouching the images. That's been a big issue in makeup. But the 24-hour promise in particular has already been litigated, where Maybelline had the 24-hour line. And the court ended up saying, No reasonable person would really believe it was 24 hours, and people, you know, buy makeup because of the shade, and not really because they expect it to last 24 hours. My students actually divide very sharply on this. This case is a little different because what happened was they have this 24-hour makeup line, and then some of the products have sunscreen. And so they put the 24-hour coverage, and then they put sunscreen right underneath it. But my understanding is, as a matter of the chemistry of it, it is impossible for sunscreen to last 24 hours. Just won't happen. You do need to reapply. And of course, if you, it's not like, well, I guess my lip doesn't look as nice, right? The absence of sunscreen can have a pretty detrimental effect on you. So the court recently allowed a claim to go forward saying, you know, maybe a reasonable consumer might take away the message that the sunscreen would last for 24 hours because, you know, that's just different. And just because, you know, the color wore off actually doesn't necessarily mean the sunscreen did either, right? There's no way to know unless you know kind of the chemistry of it, which a reasonable person doesn't have to. So I'm interested to see where that case goes.
So I'm curious, the claims here, are these primarily under the Lanham Act, or are these almost like contractual claims where you're going, this was a contract between you and me, yeah, and you violated it?
So these are state consumer protection law claims, and also warranty claims. So there is a federal law, the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, which basically makes it possible to bring souped up warranty claims if you already have a warranty claim under state law. Those are kind of the laws that people generally assert were violated.
And generally speaking, I mean, I've been involved in some of these in the context of like food, but have you seen these primarily being brought in certain jurisdictions versus other jurisdictions?
Absolutely. California. So first of all, California is at least 20% of the nation's economy. It's got a whole lot of the people. It's got a whole lot of the money. It's also got pretty favorable consumer protection laws. So California is far and away the most popular jurisdiction. But there are other states that have kind of capacious consumer protection laws. So New York, Illinois, New Jersey, reasonably popular, but it's very hard to have a nationwide consumer class action. Maybe impossible at this point. You know, California first, everybody else lines up after California.
I think we've run out of time, but before we go, any last parting words to summarize our discussion?
My basic take on cases these days is, you know, stuff is getting weird, right? As all these new judges start making decisions. So, you know, I like to remind people, a third of the federal judges in the country were appointed in the last 6 years. That makes a difference, not just courtrooms in Miami, Florida.
For assistance with your advertising compliance needs, call me at 302-252-6959. That's 302-252-6959.